Welcome to Oakland. Coming at you all the way live from deep East Oakland. No longer in the West. Got to start saying that I'm no longer in the West. Today's show, I got to talk to a person I've had on once on the podcast like this, and then we did our first ever live stream with this particular guest, Dr. Michael Harris, who wrote a book that I'm very fond of. If you've heard me on this show talk about it, Welcome to the Rebellion, A New Hope in Radical Politics, which uses the Star Wars movies as a grand narrative for the left. Michael Harris has a new book coming out in April, and he shot me the advanced copy. I've had it for a little bit, and I finally picked it up. And you might have heard me say this before. I don't like reading digitally. Like, articles here and there I can do, but, like, entire books in a digital format is kind of hard for me. I do like the highlighting aspect of it. It's a little easier. A little cooler. But other than that, it just takes me a little longer to get to a digital book. But I finally got to it because I did want to talk to Dr. Harris again, because as you're going to hear us talk about on the show, I really feel like the Star Wars people read his book in some of the new episodes of The Mandalorian and even some of the cartoons, which I think actually came out before the book. But they definitely identify the inequality that existed before the Empire comes to be, and even after. So if you watch The Mandalorian, all of it actually takes place in kind of the space ghetto, right? The Outer Rim for Star Wars is their space hinterland or space ghetto, whatever you want to call it. But it's definitely a place where all the ne'er-do-wells dwell. So they actually have been tackling the fact that the Republic was a colonizing force, much like the Empire is or was. And there's an episode with Bill Burr, and I'll talk about it on the you'll hear me and Dr. Harris talk about it, where he's calling out these inequalities. And he's calling out to the Mandalorian, these people don't care, you know, Empire, Republic. It's all the same shit to them. In Dr. Harris's book, they're not all doom and gloom books where he's explaining or describing a current situation. Like, I'm a fan of Chris Hedges, and I get a lot of shit from my leftist friends, especially now that we're on Zero Books every Wednesday. You can catch a new live stream of This Is Revolution on the Zero Books YouTube channel. Plug, plug, pluggity, plug, plug. And he paints some dark pictures of doom and gloom, and he tries to add a little hope at the end. But if you've ever read a book like War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, which I think is an excellent book, it's not very happy. There's like no hope at the end. It's a very dark book. And so is America, the Farewell Tour. But Dr. Harris uses pop culture in a way to show us certain things, like using Star Wars as a narrative for the left, as a narrative for hope, as a narrative for collective rebellion. And I've never seen The Hunger Games. And when he first told me about it, so usually when I talk to someone, we talk for like 10, 20 minutes, depending on who the guest is, if they have time. And then we do the show. If I can squeeze a couple hours out of them, because now I have a new format where I go an hour, anything over an hour, we're going to Patreon with it. If I can squeeze some time out of people, you know, we'll talk for three, sometimes four hours. Dr. Harris and I talked like all day. And then we were talking before the live stream that we did, because I was really nervous about doing one live stream. So I did it with Dr. Harris and another brilliant thinker, Arash Kalahi, who's actually coming back on the show. I'm doing an interview with him coming up in a few weeks. So look for another brand new Arash Kalahi interview where he's going to give some more brilliant takes. And the reason why I like those two guys is they have a way of laying out the situation simple and plain. I'm not going to beat around the bush. Here are the problems, and here's how I feel we can combat said problems. And never watching The Hunger Games, I'm not going to lie, I was kind of this shitty elitist attitude that it bit off of Battle Royale, and it seemed a little teeny boppery. And I was like, Battle Royale is this dope-ass movie, and I don't want to watch some teeny bopper rip-off of Battle Royale. And I believe the author did write it towards a teen audience, and she got a deal with, she got a deal with a movie company, got a deal with Hot Topics, so it definitely was all the rage. The books were, and then definitely the apparel and the movies were. They made like 4 or 5 movies. I just didn't care to watch them. I was like, fuck this bullshit. It's biting off Battle Royale. And I told that to Dr. Harris, and he kept telling me, yeah, you should watch them. Just don't be such a dick. You know, the lady claims she didn't know about Battle Royale. And much like music, where sometimes we think someone stole our riff or someone stole our idea, which is a conversation I've had with my music friends more times than I can count. Sorry, as I'm talking to you right now, my phone blew up because there's some sort of Amber Alert. And in the background, if you can hear, my 2-year-old son is watching one of his favorite movies and screaming uncontrollably. But we will move on. I was like, let me just read this book. And in reading the book, it's definitely making me want to go watch the movie. So I went to go like try to watch The Hunger Games, and I can't find it for free. I have to pay for it, and I'm very, very broke right now. So I can't even afford to pay for The Hunger Games, which has been out since like 2012. And that's a whole different podcast episode to talk about. But in reading the book, I definitely think he gets the point across, and he describes the movie so well that, I definitely want to go watch it, much like the Star Wars book made me go watch all 9 movies again. And what, 11 total, because we watched, my 2-year-old and I even watched Solo and Rogue One again after reading that book. And I want to read this little part from the intro of the book just to give you an idea. The Hunger Games isn't just the brutally honest name of the annual fight to the death competition organized by the Capitol, the city that dominates Panem, and Panem is America, right? It's in this futuristic world. It's the way that its elite controls the districts. Starvation, scarcity, and minimal rewards doled out to subvert districts. The Capitol uses hunger as a weapon against the masses. It's also a powerful metaphor for the economic system we live under today, so much so that the Hunger Games has now become shorthand for an especially brutally competitive environment or economy. And the book is about capitalism's collapse, the collapse of societies, or societies collapsing under capitalism. And he does a great job of writing this and explaining this by using the Hunger Games, but also kind of showing us the way to fight this is solidarity and not working in silos. And we talk a lot about that in the episode, and also in the episode we veer off a little bit from the book, because when we are recording this was the second time in less than 10 days that my Facebook profile was deleted by Facebook. So I was a little flustered from that, and I was gonna try to reschedule it, and Dr. Harris was going through some stuff where he's staying now, and then we were like, no, fuck it, let's just do the show. Let's do the show, and let's just riff. And before we knew it, we had two episodes in. We have this episode that you're gonna hear, and if you'd like to hear the second half of the conversation, which was always a little more raw and just a little more interesting, I think, because we're 2 hours into a conversation, become a patron. It's easy. It's affordable. It's fun. And you can hear the other half of this conversation. You can hear the other half of the conversation I had just recently with Professor Dylan Rodriguez, where he goes off on Van Jones and tells some really interesting Van Jones stories from dealing with him in 1999. Really takes the the shine off that whole Van Jones was a Maoist thing when you hear these stories that Professor Rodriguez and actually another friend of mine tells of Van Jones. But back to my episode with Dr. Harris. I'm excited about his book. There's definitely going to be buy links to the book in the description. So wherever you're listening to this, there are links in the description to get the previous book, Welcome to the Rebellion, which I love. We are going to do another episode with Dan Larson, Dr. Harris. I'm going to see if we can get Derek Varn on. I'm calling my shot right now. I haven't even talked to him about it, so I'm going to do it here on this podcast. I'm going to see if we can get Derek Varn. Maybe Jean Bajelan. Definitely Pascal, my co-host, is a big fan. Like, it's going to be one of those, like, big episodes when we do this. We'll definitely talk about Star Wars and Hunger Games and maybe some other sci-fi things that speak to greater problems that we deal with daily. RoboCop, for me, is just the perfect explanation of neoliberalism, in my opinion. So maybe we can get this panel of great thinkers and pop culture aficionados to chime in on that. If you guys have any ideas, please feel free to message me on Facebook. I am back on Facebook, but not as my name, Jason Miles. I'm on there with my first and middle name, Jason Lionel. They wouldn't let me have my name. My name was banned. And I couldn't get on even with a different email. I had to get a second phone number. It was a whole pain in the ass. So I don't know why I'm saying this on here, because maybe they're going to ban me again. I hope a third time doesn't happen. That was really going to frustrate the shit out of me, because I'm tired of losing shit. The second banning was, ugh. Anyway. So here is the episode with Dr. Michael Harris, author of the upcoming book, Stay Alive, coming out on Zero Books. And also, don't forget, every Wednesday, a new stream comes out on Zero Books. And we are working it out that every Tuesday, Doug plays a clip that I make for him. And I don't make Doug, so if anybody here listens to Zero Books, Doug Lane makes these really trippy. I actually like his videos. I think they're very artistic. Someone commented that they didn't like the music in the video that Doug had put up, that it was distracting. I will say this to anyone that has anything to say about that. I am a musician. And this podcast, everything I do, comes from me making music first. So everything I do is probably going to have music in it, because I like creating music. These are, for me, the music to those clips are like a score to the person talking. And listening to the person talk, I have to listen to the whole thing, and then I get a feel of the rhythm of the conversation, and that makes me find the BPMs that I want to go for. And so that's where that comes from, and it's not going to stop because a few people have a problem with it. Deal with it. So again, here is the episode with Dr. Michael Harris. I will shut up now. Thank you very much. And become a patron in here the second half. Peace. All right. Coming at you all the way live from the town. And today I am speaking with a return guest. This is the third time I've spoken with this gentleman. And if you know anything about this show and me and even other shows I've gone on, I constantly shill for this man and his first book on Zero Books called Welcome to the Rebellion. Welcome to the Rebellion is a book that uses Star Wars as a grand narrative for the left. And it makes me watch Star Wars in a whole different light. He had told me when we were off air that he was writing another book using the Hunger Games to kind of explain the downfall of capitalism. And once again, he's done a masterful job. I've never seen the Hunger Games. And I started reading the book thinking, damn it, maybe I should watch this movie. But I'm reading the book, I'm like, I don't think I need to watch this movie because he's explaining it oh so well. I am talking about Dr. Michael Harris.
Hi, Jason. Good to be back. Thank you.
I was just on someone else's show recently. And I was talking about your book, Welcome to the Rebellion. And in the introduction, you write, this book is about how a real empire of authoritarianism and corporate domination has now come for us. It rose to power within weakened and corrupted republics. It promised order and security, but relies on domination and fear, and now threatens our existence on a planetary scale. But also, it's about hope. You do a great job, and this is just my opinion. I don't know if other people have told you this, and I'm writing this actually for you in a blurb for the new book. You do a good job of not just explaining the crisis, but also trying to give some hope. I don't know if people tell you that with your books, but
I think I missed the last part of that.
Okay. I said you do a good job at explaining the crisis and also giving hope.
Right.
And I think that's missing in a lot of people's like analysis. It's always like doom and gloom. Like I'm a big fan of Chris Hedges, you know, to the chagrin of some of my leftist friends. But he's really great on the doom and gloom and a little light on the hope.
Sure. Well, I mean, but any objective assessment of the times in which we live, you know, hopelessness or certainly a kind of recognition of the seriousness of the depth of things is the starting point, right? What we do, what we then do from there, it's a different question.
I think, okay, so real quick back to your first book, and I don't want to spend too much time on the first book. So I'm watching the new show The Mandalorian with my 2-year-old son, and the more I'm watching the show, I'm going, I think they read Dr. Harris's book. Because they're actually talking about the inequality of the Outer Rim and how even the Republic is a bit of a colonizing force throughout the galaxy. and they're calling out a lot of the inequality. And I'm even seeing that in some of these other the cartoons. We've been watching the cartoon Rebels, and I'm like, they had to have read the book.
I didn't get an acknowledgement.
Have you been watching it at all? The Mandalorian. Do you watch that at all?
I saw the first series of The Mandalorian. I really enjoyed it, and I enjoy that setting. I enjoy that setting of, like you say, the outer rim, the left behind areas. You know, the main stories, the three trilogies. And since I thought that had kind of run its course, and people have different opinions on the last few films, but one of the criticisms that was made by people, David Brin is very good in kind of criticizing this focus on the royal family, as it were, at the center of the story, you know, the Skywalkers. And we get glimpses of parts of the rest of the galaxy, the left behind areas, the areas in which there's still slavery and rampant corruption and criminal gangs are running things along with the Empire and so on. And what I like is the opportunity in all this new Star Wars stuff to tell stories set in those other parts of the world, and that kind of more gritty feeling about it. And it does give you a perspective on the corruption of the Republic and how it was sufficiently weak that it could be turned into an empire. This is one of the things that Lucas always said. It's not like the Empire came along out of nowhere. It came out of the Republic and the corruption and the inequality and the slavery and the fact that there were people were living in two different galaxies in a way. You know, the center worlds, which had all the technology and the progress and the wealth, and these vast swathes of the galaxy that were shut out of that. Yeah, so I really liked it. I think there are a lot more stories they can tell in those worlds, actually.
Well, when you watch the second season, there's an episode with comedian Bill Burr. His character comes back surprisingly, and I don't want to spoil too much of it for you, but basically they go to a planet that's being mined by the Empire, but then the Mandalorian finds out that before the Empire was there, the Republic was there doing the same thing. So the people of the planet just don't care, like, who's there. And they make that a point. And there's a great monologue that one of the Empire generals gives to Bill Burr's character about how the people will be begging for the Empire to come back.
Right.
So it's interesting how they're running this. And as I'm watching this, I'm going, they had to have. I know Favreau had to have read. If he didn't read it, then the other guy, Dave Filoni, is that his name? Then
yeah.
He read it. But somebody at Disney read this book.
Well, let's hope so, and let's hope my lawyer can prove that in court, so I can get a massive payday out of the Disney Corporation.
Yeah, they'll probably try to settle and bring you in as a writer.
Oh, that's what I'm open for a deal. Let's negotiate. It doesn't need to be public. They don't need to issue a formal public apology. That's okay, as long as there's cash involved.
I'm not mad at you, and I'm one of your bigger fans, and I'm always talking about your work with this book, and I actually know people that have gone out to get it. After I've gone on and on and on about it.
No, I really appreciate that. I do see you doing that, and I hear you mentioning it on the podcast, and I really appreciate it.
The goal was recently, and also to let people know, recently we did a pretty big show with some Zero Books people, Derek Varn and Jean Bajelon, and also Dan Larson from Toy Galaxy. who enjoyed the episode you and I had. And it was kind of after the Capitol got stormed and Dan wanted to get some stuff off his chest that he, of course, can't do on his channel because it's about pop culture and toys and cartoons. And originally I wanted to have you on and I was like, this is going to be like the ultimate, but you couldn't make it. And so we're going to have to figure out a way to redo that. Because that was going to be really good because I wanted to dive into this new book, Stay Alive, which is about the Hunger Games. And like I said before, I have never seen the Hunger Games and I didn't want to watch the Hunger Games. I'll be honest, because I thought it was a ripoff of, from what I was seeing imagery wise, of a really good Japanese movie called Battle Royale.
Yeah.
And in reading your book, I don't think it is at all. It seems like a totally different movie with some really good class analysis in it.
Yeah, Susan Collins, the author of the Hunger Games series, she claims she had never heard of Battle Royale, which, you know, is possible. I mean, it's a cult movie and famous in cult circles and was a kind of slow burner. Got more and more famous, I think, as time has gone on.
You're right.
But the, I mean, whether you kind of believe her or not, the idea of kids being put into a kind of violent situation where they have to fight each other, you know, goes back further than that. You think about Lord of the Flies and so on. And the idea of a kind of corrupt elder elite that tries to manage young people and manages its own fundamental fear of, I would say, the revolutionary potential of young people, you know, is a theme you've had in various books and films for decades, I think. So it's possible, but I understand that because I saw Battle Royale and was familiar with that before I really started thinking more seriously about the Hunger Games. And it was not my generation's books or films. You know, I was more Star Wars. That's what I grew up with. So I wasn't that familiar with the Hunger Games before I started to think about pop culture metaphors for the things younger people in particular are thinking and feeling about the dystopia we're heading into. And that's when I really started to interrogate it a bit more.
So you've seen Battle Royale. Did you think Battle Royale had any sort of class discussion in it? Because I don't remember it having anything like that. It was just more like kids killing each other with random objects.
Well, I mean, one of the common critical interpretations of Battle Royale is that it's about the kind of lost generation of kids in the 90s in particular in Japan. You know, you had the Japanese economic miracle and then that collapsed, and essentially they've gone through a kind of 15-20 year recession, and the shock that had on such a previously kind of stable, ordered society, and revealed the kind of, again, the elder corruption, the elders hanging on to power. And so a lot of people interpret it actually in that, through that political economy lens. And certainly the writer of the original book, through his wartime experience, actually, that was what inspired it originally. He saw how the Japanese elite, the wartime elite and the emperor and so on, were sacrificing the population and the young population in an unwinnable war. And so he was, it's not so much class, I suppose, but it's more a kind of generational anger he had about how older elites can use and exploit younger people to the point of death. And so that does run through the thing. And then there are various kind of smaller class things you can pick out in the relationship between various characters in the in the book and the film, some people say.
I haven't seen the movie in probably, what year is this, 2021? I think the last time I saw it was 2008. So
right.
I'm a little fuzzy. And the last version I had of it had no subtitles.
Okay.
Here's a funny story. I lost everything in 2008 financially and a marriage. And I took a job.
Starting off is a very funny story, Jason. I got to say.
this is the comedy's coming, right?
Okay.
I took a Greyhound bus for 3.5 days to the Gulf of Mexico to go cook on oil rigs. And I forget how I had a copy of it, Battle Royale. And I'm in a bunch of kind of angry, what you would call rednecks, maybe. And I played it for some guys one night, and it's a 24-hour job. It's a 7-day-a-week, 24-hour job. So you're working every day. And you work 12 hours, and you try to rest for 12 hours. So in our 12-hour rest for this crew, for some reason, we all kind of got along pretty well. And I was like, I got this movie. It's a foreign film, though. And they're like, I don't like all the foreign films, all the subtitles. I was like, well, there's no subtitles on it. So I would have to sit there and explain it to people, some of the parts that were going on, because there's a lot of action in that movie that explains itself. Yeah. But the whole program, I remember I had to explain to guys. And once I did, it became like the most popular film on the rig. And people kept like, hey, man, I want to watch that Chinese movie you got.
Yeah. It's a great movie. And one of the differences between Battle Royale and the Hunger Games is, it's not in Battle Royale. It's not, as far as I remember, it's not a kind of public spectacle.
No.
So one of the additional kind of layers you have in the Hunger Games, which again speaks to the experience of young people, I think we'll come back to that again and again, is living in a world of social media and Instagram and the importance of appearance. And you have to display that you're living your best life, and all that kind of additional psychological, emotional pressure that young people experience now. That I didn't when I was growing up. Thank God there wasn't social media
and all
of this stuff.
Yeah.
So the addition of that public game playing, which weaves through the story and the way it screws the young people up about what is reality, what is just appearance and acting. It's a very prominent theme in the books and the films, and I think adds to the importance of the story to a lot of people who did grow up with it, unlike me.
And you know, it's good. I feel like a lot of these movies that have some sort of even mild dystopian future, the Running Man, if you remember the Running Man with Arnold Schwarzenegger in the 80s, another movie where there's like a game show of people fighting to live, poor people fighting to live, right?
Yeah, right. I think they're prisoners, aren't they? They're convicts in that.
Yeah.
You get a chance to be released if you win. Yeah.
And no one wins, right? That's the whole thing. Right. No one wins.
No one ever wins the games.
And part of the Running Man, if you remember, was that Arnold Schwarzenegger finds the big pile of dead bodies, the skulls of all the guys that were supposed to have won. And they had like superimposed like, oh no, people actually do win. Because if people knew that everyone dies, they wouldn't support the show or the project. You'd have mutiny on your hands. You'd have a riot. You'd have a rebellion.
And this theme of the kind of falseness of meritocracy is something I talk about in the book. I mean, quite consciously, the president of this corrupt dystopia in the story, says you've got to give people a little bit of hope. It's false hope, but you've got to give them a little bit of hope. I could just go out and shoot kids to keep people in line. This is what he says in the story. But the more effective way of doing it is to have this competition in which people feel they might just be able to win. They might just be able to become a rich and famous celebrity in the capital, you know, and that's what really keeps the social order together. If there's just this little bit of light coming in the darkness that they can hang on to.
And another person that's actually really good at that too, another person from your hood, your motherland, if you will, is Charles Booker that does Black Mirror. Is that his name?
Charlie Brooker, yeah.
There's an episode of Black Mirror where, and you later find out that there is an entire universe where these shows kind of exist in, right? These episodes exist in one kind of continuous universe. And there's an episode where these people are riding a bike that creates energy. And it's kind of a horrible existence, right? And there's a game show that they can get on. And if you win the game show, then you can get off the bike. And the game show is like an American Idol type game show.
Right.
And one of the characters wins the game show and doesn't have to ride the bike anymore. But the woman that he actually cared about gets turned out into horrible life she didn't necessarily want to get the bike. And to your point about this false hope, like that was the one thing that everybody could look forward to, right? In that world was, well, maybe, just maybe, you can win the American Idol type game show, and get out of this rat race.
I think it was the Running Man that inspired American Gladiators, that TV show. And the producer of what would become American Gladiators pointed to the Running Man and said to his staff, "This is what I want, just without the murdering." direct quote. Well, you know,
it's insane.
It's insane. And but now, I mean, I don't watch this crap. But you have game shows in which people are starved. You have game shows in which people can be easily injured. You've had Big Brother episodes in some countries in which people have died. I mean, we are inches away from this stuff. You know, this isn't really so much science fiction or fantasy, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, you had a president who was who displayed that kind of violent game show ethos. We're going to storm the Capitol. People are going to die. He knew that.
What did you think? And I know you're not here in the States right now. What did you think when the news hit? Because I know news hits differently when you're not in the country sometimes or stuff. Mm.
About the 6th of January.
Yeah. And juxtapose that to your book.
I mean, I was kind of picking up on it through social media, but it didn't really register with me what was happening. You know, I was kind of working away and seeing, oh, okay, you know, Trump protest, whatever. And then I think, like a lot of people, the more footage I saw and the more violent footage I saw, it really hit home to me that this was an insurrection. You know, at first we saw kind of weird people running around and the guy with the horns or whatever. And he was these are kind of buffoons or whatever. And then I think as more footage started to come out that people had recorded and so you got more of a sense of they were looking to kill people. If they had found some of the representatives and Pence and Pelosi and so on, they would have killed them. They would have killed them. And obviously we've been saying for 4 or 5 years, you need to take this stuff seriously. This is fascism. And that was seen as alarmist and dramatic, and, you know, the left crying wolf again. Now you believe us. Yeah. Now Facebook and Twitter realize what they've been profiting off of. And this is what happens. And people get killed.
Now you have these nice, I like the way you write for someone like me is perfect, because they're almost like short little essays within each chapter.
Yeah, that's what I try and do. Yeah.
And it makes me feel like I'm reading a lot more than I actually am. But this one right here, I want to read, because I think I even put a note here to read this part. These things happen in war. This essay is called Panem is found on a core conservative idea. And Panem is the place where this all takes place in the Hunger Games.
Yeah. It's the new America.
Panem is new America, right? Panem is found on a core conservative idea, one that still holds a powerful grip on today's politics, that the state restrains us from all out civil war. This was first set out by the English philosopher Thomas Hobbes, particularly in his most famous book, Leviathan. Hobbes was informed by the English Civil War, or Civil Wars of 1642 to 46 and 1648 to 51. He often uses the word rebellion that led to the execution of the king and the declaration of a republic. At the time, England was divided politically, economically, socially, religiously, then militarily. This was also an age of radical new movements. For example, the Levellers called for much greater equality in wealth and political rights, while the Diggers fought for the abolition of wage labor. But these flourishing demands for justice and democracy were exactly what Hobbes warned against. His argument was rooted in a deeply pessimistic view of human behavior dressed up in some crude science, as conservatives still do today. We are driven by greed and fear. Without an authoritarian state, we compete, often violently, to secure the necessities of life and seek reputation, glory, both for its own sake and greater security. Hobbes' state of nature is perpetual strife, endless dark days compromising a war of all against all, leavened only by temporary alliances to stave off greater or graver threats and imminent perils. Hobbes thought that the inevitable condition of humankind was one in which life is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. A relentless quest for power that seetheth only in death. In such bleakness, there is no alternative to strong central government. Even limiting its powers to seize the goods of its subjects without their consent undermines it. Our only, quote-unquote, hope is all-powerful authority. People must surrender their power to the ultimate peacekeeper, the sovereign ruler. But in reality, this idea just normalizes the actions of some selfish, amoral people as natural, and supports exploitation and right-wing authoritarianism, even fascism. I read that and I was like, man, let me highlight this, because I feel like this has a lot to do with where we are today.
Yeah. What spoke to you about that? What cut through about that?
I remember having a conversation. I was on a radio show with somebody, and we were having a debate about Jordan Peterson for some odd effing reason, and kind of flippantly and very, very sarcastically, I was like, what, you need someone to tell you how to clean your room? And he looked at me very seriously. This is like an adult man. And he says, sometimes I need people to tell me to clean my room.
Yeah.
And it kind of fucked my head up. And there are people that look to politicians, the state, for order and for savior. And I feel like right now post Bernie Sanders in my country in the U.S. People are kind of waiting for Superman when it comes to politicians on both sides, on the left and the right. And I think we saw what happens on the right when they're waiting for that Superman.
Yeah. One of the people I reference in the book is a psychologist called Alice Miller, who is very good on people's desire, attachment to authority, and how that can shade into authoritarianism and the desire for the strong father figure, and the way that can often be in her work, she argues it's a kind of outcome of childhood trauma that we haven't dealt with, that we then act out and seek to pass on to other people, and how that can transfer into politics. And you absolutely saw this with Trump, right? I mean, there were some people who saw him as daddy, saw him as the father figure, and very much kind of emotionally and psychologically gravitated towards that abusive, cruel, mean, inconsistent father figure, because it was kind of comfortable, because it echoed something. You know, one of the things I think about a lot is how we, if we're interested in politics, those people are interested in politics and political ideas and ideologies and economics and so on. That's how we tend to think about politics, but it's much more emotional and much more psychological than particularly we on the left, I think, often like to acknowledge or think about. And I think the era we're living in, if it does one thing, or one of the things it should do, is remind us how emotional and psychological politics is. And, you know, political scientists are proving this in their work, in the way that Trump demonstrates as well. Trump normally, kind of rhetorically, reversed some of the core Republican positions, you know, on free trade, on deficits and so on, virtually overnight when he became the Republican Party candidate. And you saw in the polling evidence how Republican voters flipped overnight with him.
Yes, yes.
So they had been, you know, self-proclaimed, long-standing believers in family values, and, you know, traditional conservative values and smaller government and reducing the deficit and the debt and international trade deals and so on. And they flipped overnight once the father figure had said, no, we're not doing that anymore. We're doing something else. Their positions reversed. And that's about emotions and psychology and someone's desire to be a follower, you know?
I did get to the Alice Miller part of the book, and I started to find that really fascinating, because I think that's why there's figures on the right that have such big bases, a la Jordan Peterson and even Sam Harris. Yeah. They do become a father figure for people that are so, you know, a generation that is kind of disconnected from everything. Everyone is looking at their device all the time. My 2-year-old son reminds me how much I don't want to look at my device when I'm looking at a message or something, and he's running around and he's looking at me. He sees me with the phone in my hand, he just walks away. Like, well, you're not going to pay attention to me. You're looking at that thing.
Yeah.
I'm like, damn, man. Let me go throw this in a whole nother place or turn it off. And let me just be around you being 2 for a minute and enjoy that moment, because these times are a fleeting. So I see the connection people have to these voices that talk for hours on end. Some of these people have like podcasts and things that go for like 2.5, 3 hours. Pops is talking to you for a minute.
Yeah. It's interesting. This is one of the things I get into in the book as well. It's kind of the conservative critical characterizations of young people, you know, that they're all snowflakes and they're spoiled and they're overparented and so on. But what you're pointing to is underparenting. And that's the gap in which the Jordan Petersons wiggle their way in, isn't it? Because it's the underparenting obviously, you know, parents are too stressed, they're distracted, they're exhausted themselves from the economy in which they have to operate and the stress and so on. So of course they're as tempted as anyone to distract themselves, you know, in virtual worlds and on their phones and so on. And I'm not a parent myself, and you know, I have no idea how difficult it must be. But I see parents, you know, they're in a restaurant and the parents are on the phones and the kids are sitting there starting to get restless and they want to be parented, not in an authoritarian way, not to be taught obedience, but just to be related to as human beings.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they don't get it.
Or the parent gives the kid the phone or they give them some device, which we've been kind of against with this little one. And actually I don't even think there was devices around my other kids. And you know, I don't want to watch Chicken Little, the Disney animated show, for the 100th time, but I'd rather watch Chicken Little, the animated show, with him for the 100th time and get up when he says, "Dad, let's get up and dance at this song," because, you know, I don't want the Jordan Petersons of the world to fill that void.
Yeah. And they will. They're looking for the opportunities.
They
and
are.
It's good, and there's good money in it.
And another thing about your book, back to my original point about your writing, which is that you do such a good job of taking pop culture, using it as a metaphor for real problems, but then at the end of the day, you always give a way out. Like, there has to be a message of hope, because when there is no message of hope, then you're just hopeless. And your message of solidarity that kind of runs through this story in The Hunger Games is really interesting, because even on the left, I think we don't understand people say solidarity, but they really understand solidarity.
Go on.
No, I was going to say I struggle with it.
What do you struggle with?
I'll be a little transparent. I made a comment the other night on a show, and it was a slightly negative comment about a larger person on the left who has a tendency to come off a little, what's the right word? You have a better vocabulary than me. They come off a little too rich.
Mm-hmm.
So even though they speak about certain working class issues, they're definitely not of the working class, because they also talk about, you know, silly shit like loving to go on Fox News because you get your hair and makeup done, and then that way you can be all made up for your downtown Manhattan dinner engagements that you had planned around your Fox News appearance. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? No one I know and work with understands anything about that, but this person actually does have a really good political analysis of how the inner workings of electoral politics work. And I probably shouldn't be so judgmental, because I think they're a little too bougie, because they do offer something for the greater movement, right?
Well, I mean, there's a history. I don't obviously know what figure you're talking about, and I wouldn't be able to make a judgment on them. But there's a tradition of you know, rich kids who play politics, especially on the left.
Mm-hmm.
There's reasons to be wary of certain people, certainly.
And most of it comes from the fact that it's just, you know, when you hear real people problems, like I've had Chris Smalls on my show, the young man that's trying to form a union with Amazon. He got fired for trying to organize at Amazon, and it became kind of a big story. And my big question for him is like, well, how did you even get people to agree to walk out the door? Because at the same time that he was doing his thing at Amazon, I was working at one of these emergency shelters we have here in California. And the conditions were really, really horrible for everybody. And no one cared as far as management, because management was there to get a promotion. When you take on a big job like that, a big government program like that, you will get a promotion when all is said and done if nobody dies. And you don't make a big stink, and there's not like negative press and shit, right? You can suppress everything. And one of my coworkers had, you know, just has a lot of issues. And she, and this is a coworker, she had just cleaned up and management didn't know that she was like on methadone. And we were talking about, like, you know, we were having serious problems in this place, like she had gotten physically threatened with violence, and nothing really happened too much with the person that had threatened her with violence. And when we're talking about trying to like come together and bring these complaints, our issues, our concerns to management, you know, she didn't really want to rock the boat. And she was like, I was getting raped every night selling ass before this, like literally weeks before I got this job. I'm not going to fuck this up. This $20 an hour is the most money I've ever gotten before in my life, legally. And when you're like a rich kid that's that disconnected from, and she wasn't the only story like that. And then you go off about, you know, your hatred of paper straws and overpriced iced lattes.
Yeah,
I kind of, I can be mildly dismissive, but I think, again, this person actually has, again, really good political analysis.
Do you know one of the ways this comes out for me, and I talk about this in the book, is in attitudes towards the state.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'm more on the libertarian socialist side,
mm-hmm.
just instinctively. But that relates to class, and that relates to experiences when I was younger and how you feel about authority and your experience of authority, you know, teachers, doctors, police forces, and so on. In the book, there's one chapter in particular where I talk about Appalachia, because for those who are unfamiliar with the Hunger Games, the place where the main character Katniss comes from is in a future Appalachia, and it's the most downtrodden, kind of dejected, criticized, stereotyped district in this future America, as it is in, well, arguably, yeah, in the current America.
Right? Well, it really is. It really is like that in real life. I've been there several times.
Right. So, yeah. And chosen for that precise reason by the author, you know, to make some class points. And so I talk about, you know, the politics of places like that. And of course, we've got them in England and every country. And how, you know, lots of people on the left talk about the state with the assumption that it's some kind of benign, helpful friend. Well, that is not the experience you have had of the state in its various forms. If you come from a poorer background, if you come from a rural background, you know, there is the state is this hostile, cold, uncaring, often authoritarian, policing thing that will often steal from you, or has historically stolen from you. And here, you know, here comes the middle class left and saying, oh, we want to extend the state. We want to give you something. And it's no wonder people don't trust it.
Yeah.
Not only do they not think it will happen, but they think, based on their own experience, that the feeling of engaging with that state, whether for their healthcare or any other kind of protection, will be cold, impersonal, demeaning, embarrassing, policing. And that's something which I think, you know, this is not about disliking people who, just because of their background, but that's something I think people who are from a more middle class background who are on the left don't often understand about working classes, people's view of the state and how they hear these promises about an extension of the state into their lives.
And I don't think a lot of people understand that. Like, we have our own subway system here in the Bay Area called BART, Bay Area Rapid Transit. And they just announced that now they're going to dispatch social workers instead of police for certain mental health episodes that happen on the train system.
Right.
So if anyone doesn't know, there is a horrible homeless problem here in the Bay Area, mostly in San Francisco and Oakland, the two major cities. Or I guess I'll say the whole Bay Area, because San Jose has a very bad homeless problem as well. And someone had responded to the article on social media that actually worked in the counseling world, that this may not be as good as people think, because a lot of times these counselors are just another extension of policing. Because that's the way they look at the issue, is policing the problem. And B, it'll probably be underfunded anyway.
Yeah.
And then that goes like, well, see, we tried it your way. We just got to lock them up. So it's a lot of people are rejoicing that kind of, like you said, that middle class stuff. Like, yeah, that's what we wanted. We wanted more social workers. It's like, yeah. But what is the strategy? Because I've seen the social work policing of mental illness.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I don't want more people coming. This is the way middle class people's experience of the state is often fundamentally different from people in poorer communities and working class people. They do not experience the state as an intrusion into their lives. And they get treated with respect by the state because they're nice middle-class professionals. Obviously, not always, mm-hmm. but, you know, if you're educated, if you've been to university and so on, you are going to be treated differently in many circumstances by the state than if you're not. And again, it's the emotional and psychological dimension of politics, which on the left we forget sometimes. There's a reason why people in Alabama, Kentucky, you know, these states, when they hear promises about we're gonna give you this, we're gonna give you that, we're gonna provide that, they view it with suspicion. It's not just brainwashing by Fox News. That's part of it. But it's not just that. It's wanting to be. Of course, everyone wants to be supported and have security, protection, and so on. But none of us want intrusion into our lives. None of us want that policing.
And I don't think those people see that policing on the daily level.
No,
because right. you're so disconnected from it.
Yeah, that's right.
And not only did I work with homeless people, I lived among them.
There's a, so, I mean, it's not something I mentioned. I don't think I mentioned it in the book. Maybe there's a fleeting reference to it, but I was always interested in a kind of approach to public services that in the academic jargon is called co-production, which, and fundamentally the point is it doesn't start from the bureaucracy, it starts from the person, and it starts in recognizing what the person can do, and says, and then just says, what do you need? What do you need? Not this is what we think you need.
Mm-hmm.
This is our program, which we've proved through scientific studies, you know, works elsewhere. Doesn't start with that. It's a much more human and person-centered, in the jargon, way of supporting people, which the state is not very good at doing. This is one of the problems we have to think about on the left, is how do you support people? We know how to set up bureaucracies. You know, government knows how to do that, for good or ill. What it struggles to do, we have to be honest with, is support people in individual, personal ways that give them dignity or respect.
And that's the struggle, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, how do you, that's the struggle within capitalism, I should say. How do you try to give people dignity, but then come under budget at the same time?
Well, the irony is it turns out these kind of approaches are much cheaper actually than traditional public services, because you don't build a whole bureaucracy. You don't need to give people what you assume they need. What they might need is something really simple, a bit of advice about how to do something, not a 12-week training course, you know. but that's the model we go into, you know, as middle class bureaucrats. This is, we go, well, we've designed this perfect 12-week program that's going to help, you know, give people confidence to go and find a job. Have you asked them whether that's what they need? Maybe they just need a bus ticket to be able to get to a job interview.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot to be said for just giving people cash, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And not all of this other.
The ability to drive themselves somewhere, or just like public transportation that works well.
Yeah.
Like that shit is paramount. Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
Again, I didn't sit at the job. I didn't sit with my other coworkers. I sat out with the people to hear what they wanted, hear what their complaints were, because I think this is an easier way to do your job, right? If I'm just here in front of you and you can always be bitching me, and I got bitched at a lot, but at least you know I'm listening and I'm doing what I can. And I tried to do what I could to meet some of the needs, but they weren't as complex as people thought.
Yeah.
And in listening to everyone's story, sometimes it was a matter of like just connecting people. Like, oh, you can't read? Well, this lady right here used to teach before she lost everything. So why don't we set up a space where you guys can get taught?
That's absolutely another principle of co-production. So I think you'd be interested in kind of reading more about it, and it kind of echoes some of your own experiences by the sound of it, because a lot of it is just about connecting people, saying, oh, okay, so-and-so over there, another, quotes, service user, knows how to do that. Go talk to them.
Yeah.
Well, they can support you. And, of course, that gives people, again, gives people dignity, gives people a sense of, oh, I do have some skills, I do have capabilities that other people can learn from and benefit from.
Feeling normal or human is right. So huge, and you see the frustrations, because there's one thing that's growing in this country, and that's economic inequality. Maybe that's globally. You know, I don't live in the UK. I do have some good friends that I did before I got banned for the second time on Facebook in Scotland, and they were telling me some things about what's going on over there and just the frustrations with this whole Brexit in general. Have you been following any of that?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I'm an addict on, even though I'm not in the UK anymore. I mean, the whole fucking car crash. Yeah. I've been an addict of this for, what's it been, 4 years now?
Yeah. Five, right? Because it happened in 2016 or 2015.
It was the same year as your ex-president got elected. Yeah. It was in the summer. Yeah. So 4 years.
And what's your take on it right now?
On Brexit?
Yeah.
I mean, there's an emotional dimension to this again, because some of the people who voted for it will never, you know, it's a sunk cost in the sense that they were told some lies, they were manipulated, and they're going to really struggle to be able to acknowledge that it will not deliver what they were promised, the lies that they were told. You know, so actually, if you look at the polling evidence, it's been fairly, there's been a slight shift back towards people saying they wished we'd stayed in the European Union, but it was the same phenomenon, and it was a warning really about what happened later in that year in 2016 in the United States. It was a kind of populist revolt manipulated by elites, which is a pretty good definition of what fascism is as well. I'm not saying Brexit was fascism, but that's the same basic mechanism, you know, populism manipulated by elites who have something to gain from it. And everything's going to be more difficult. Trade is going to be more difficult. Travel is going to be more difficult. But we knew that. But people wanted to kick against this somewhat more imaginary liberal metropolitan elite. There is a liberal metropolitan elite, and they were directed to kick against that as a displacement activity for what they should have really been told to kick against, which was neoliberal capitalism that demeans them, that makes them feel ashamed, makes them feel like failures. It's not university professors that make people feel, you know what I mean? I mean, who the fuck listens to university professors? No, I mean, that's just a figment of the Fox News imagination. What makes people feel ashamed and demeaned and worthless is the economic system that they experience every day. And Brexit and Trump were ways of distracting people, you know. Let's criticize Mexicans. Let's criticize Eastern European people coming to the UK. They're what the problem is.
And I agree with that 100%. So what is the message of hope in the Hunger Games?
Well, it's interesting because in a sense, the first message is hopelessness, in the sense that one of the things that's running through work I've been doing for the last couple of years is I think the left needs to think much more about social collapse. And our politics isn't based around the idea that we're heading for some kind of significant social, economic, political, environmental collapse, you know? And in a way, despite their denialism of climate change, the right is much more set up for collapse and exploiting collapse. And you've seen that in your former president. He was a collapse president, maybe the first collapse president, you know. He came in talking about American carnage. And he wasn't completely wrong in that respect, in seeming to recognize, for some people, the economic and social conditions they were living in, you know. And so this is the problem with the kind of hope and unity message on the liberals or progressives can sometimes focus on, you know. People don't feel like it recognizes the depth of the crises, the multiple crises they are living in. And so the first thing the book is about is kind of using this popular culture metaphor of the Hunger Games is really recognizing the depth of the crisis we're in, we're heading into, and in some sense is unavoidable. You know, the environmental damage has been done already. No matter what we do starting today, there are storms coming, literally. So the first thing is in that sense is to recognize a hopelessness that there are some things we're not going to avoid. And once you do that, and here we get into the emotional side of it again, once you go through the process almost of grieving for a world that is lost, you can start to think more clearly about what we can build. And that's where the hope comes back into it. And I think that has huge implications for left politics, in particular about whether it's the state that provides services to us and is able to protect us. And I don't think it will be able to, given some of the crises that are still to come, the economic crises that are still to come, or whether it's a much more kind of community-based mutualism, where we build new structures to help ourselves and to care for ourselves and protect each other. And that's really where the book ends up, is the recognition about the need to do that. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense.
Okay.
He is Dr. Michael Harris. His latest book is Stay Alive on Zero Books. It comes out in April.
End of April in the UK, International Workers' Day, 1st of May in the United States.
All right. I'll have links up to the pre-order in the description of the show, as well as links up to buy Dr. Harris's previous book, Welcome to Rebellion. So I'm going to play some music. Dr. Harris, don't you?